about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Roger Fletcher, and he'll be answering your most important questions on drift boats and river dories. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Roger a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Roger Fletcher about drift boats and river dories. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. Continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers. The Federation needs to increase its membership. To more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has been so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Roger, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Roger's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Roger's book, Drift Boats and River Dories, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And to find out more about Stackpole Books, go to www.stackpolebooks.com. That's www.stackpolebooks.com. And we'll also be giving away, courtesy of Roger Fletcher, sets of construction plans and instructions for one for the traditional and original McKinsey River drift boat and the other for the 14-foot Rapid Robert. So we've got three incredible gifts tonight coming via Roger Fletcher, and so kind to offer those up. So you guys be ready to play at the end of the show here. And so here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and you'll possibly win one of three great prizes. Tonight our guest is Roger Fletcher. Roger is an educator, historian, artist, and author, and over the past 50 years he and his wife Sue have run all of Oregon's wild rivers. Their favorites are the Rogue and the Deschutes. As an educator, he believes running the whitewater in a wooden drift boat can be one of life's great teachers. As an artist, his recreations of the original boats stir recollections of his river experiences. As an author, he brings to life men and women behind the early boats. His work has reignited interest in the historical drift boats and dories. As a historian, he has recovered and established the lines and construction, each a McKinsey, Rogue, and Colorado River boat, as they evolved over time. Full-size recreations of the early boats are now being built from his book around the country and the world. The capstone of his works to date is his book, Drift Boats and River Dories, Their History, Design, Construction, and Use. Drift boats and river dories are Oregon's unique contributions to wooden boat design. McKinsey River drift boats were originally designed as a fly fishing platform. Roger enjoys fly fishing, but calls himself the accidental fly fisherman. He becomes so engrossed in river hydraulics, boat performance, and the scenery around him that his catches are quite by accident. The river's touch is as much about a sense of place as it is about the original drift boats. Roger's passion for the quiet wakes of wood on water is equally matched by his affection for the milieu of the river. His research into the origins of these lovely river craft have heightened appreciation for the men and women behind the early boats. Well, Roger, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you very much for hosting me, Roger. I'm very pleased to be here. And did I send you all that information?
Yeah.
Introduction.
Well, your wife probably wrote it for you. So.
Yeah, right.
No, lots of good information, and talks about your passion in regards to what we're going to talk about tonight, which drives you and the beautiful book you wrote. And it's quite the, I think every fly fisher that's float drift boat needs it on their shelf because it's a one of a kind. Well, Roger, let's dig in here, and got lots of questions and things to cover tonight. We'll cover a bit about the history, and we'll talk about building boats and a bit about models as well. And then we'll end the show with talking about handling drift boats on the rivers and some tips for novices and experts alike. And so that's kind of what we've got rounded out for tonight. So let's just start at the beginning. And first of all, what's the technical difference between a drift boat and a river dory?
Well, technically, there is no difference. River dory, as defined by John Gardner, who wrote the book on dories. He specialized in seafaring dories. And by the way, my interest was in attempting to do for river dories and drift boats what he has done for the seafaring dories. His definition has stood a long test of time. Basically, a dory is a boat that has slightly flared sides. They're straight, and the boat is flat across the bottom and fore to aft, and oftentimes takes on a kind of a banana shape as it comes to the bow. Some of them are double-ended. Some of them have a transom on the rear. The reason that in the book I make the distinction between drift boats and river dories is that areas where boats have been developed tend to take on the names of the areas from which they come. And on the Rogue River, the boats down there have been called river dories for a long time, and on the Mackenzie, the boats have been called drift boats. There are distinctive differences between the Mackenzie River drift boat and the Rogue River dory, hence I make that distinction and separate the two for purposes of identification in the book. And in terms of their configuration, the Mackenzie River drift boats typically have a cambered or rocker bottom, fore to aft. They're flat like any river dory is, but they have a bit of a rocker to them. Some rockers are quite accentuated, others not so. On the river dory, however, the boat has a flat spot fore to aft, up to 72 inches. And these minor differences actually change the performance of the boat as they're operating. Mackenzie River drift boat is highly maneuverable because the chine, which is the bottom edge of the boat, has less contact with the water than the Rogue River dory because of the extended chine, the flat chine. Therefore, you have greater carrying capacity in the Rogue River dory. They're not as maneuverable as the Mackenzie. Mackenzie River dory is highly maneuverable. And my interest in these boats really came when I realized that these distinctions do exist, and they are indeed Oregon's very unique contribution to wooden boat design. So technically, as far as the definition of a dory is concerned, there is really definitionally no difference between the Mackenzie River drift boat and the river dory as a dory. People on the Mackenzie, they're sensitive to that, and hence I continue to call a drift boat a Mackenzie River drift boat for that reason.
Yeah, that's definitely kept that name through the years, even with some of these modern models that aren't built from wood and so forth. A lot of people
right.
still call them Mackenzies. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of answered the next question I was going to ask, which was, you know, where are these first ancestors of today's drift boats and dories were conceived, so I'm assuming the Rogue River and Mackenzie River. But when did this all start and why?
Well, that's a very good question. In this country and in your part of the country, we're all immigrants. And so people that migrated to this country carried with them their boat experiences and their understandings of wooden boat design. So the evolution of the Mackenzies and the Colorado, or the Rogue River boats, obviously did not occur in a vacuum. There are a number, well, two or three theories relative to how these boats evolved from other parts of the world. And one that I tend to subscribe to, although to definitively say this is what happened, it's impossible. But my own theory is that these boats are tied to the New England river drivers. Back in the pre-colonial periods, transportation was fairly river dependent, and boats were developed that were designed to be driven upriver with pike poles and other devices such as oars, and run downriver. And then when development began to take place, particularly along the Maine coast and Massachusetts, the logging industry began to develop, and there needed to be a way to move logs. And one of the easiest methods to do that is to dump them into a free-flowing river. The Kennebunk River, for example, was one such. The Penobscot River was another in Maine. And these river drivers slowly evolved based on the need for a boat to be able to fairly easily run up fairly swift water with pike pole and oars and manage the downriver run, began to take on a raked bottom toward the stern and the prow of the boat. Fairly narrow amidships, anywhere from 30 to 38 inches, but they were specifically designed to take that kind of water on. As the timber industry migrated west, and it took two different routes, really, down through the southeast, then across to California, across the Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin in particular, Minnesota to a lesser degree, these log drivers moved with the industry, ending up in the Northwest. And there is a fellow by the name of Marsh Underwood who operated one of these log drivers in the team back in the mid to late 1800s on the Clearwater in Idaho, tells some very interesting and somewhat harrowing stories about herding competing logs downstream with these boats. I have found some evidence that these boats migrated the Rogue River, none that they really migrated to the Mackenzie. But if you take a look at the bank dory, which is a seafaring dory, that basically evolved from the river drivers, you will find some people who are familiar with drift boats look at the bank dory and say, oh my goodness, that's where they come from. So I do think there's a conceptual connection in terms of a definitive lineage. It's really, at this point, I think, almost impossible to tell. But that's yours truly theory anyway.
Okay. You know, are you familiar with the boats that John Wesley Powell took down the Grand Canyon?
Oh, yes.
Colorado,
yes.
Grand Canyon?
Yes.
Are those
yes.
any mixed in there at all?
Not those boats, I guess I'd call them wherries. They have V-shaped hull. And
okay.
In order to navigate those boats, you've got to be going faster than the current. With a drift boat or a river dory, the idea is to slow your descent a bit by going against the current. So the Powell boats, I think all of them had tillers, and they were rowing with the current. And I marvel at their success in negotiating that river on the first trip and their second trip. So that's the kind of boat you don't want on a river.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of wondered about that too, you know, because I've run the Grand Canyon in 18-foot raft, but I've read Powell's books and I look at the pictures and the drawings, and I go, my gosh, those were foolish or brave men wanted to do maybe a bit of both. But and hard to mover, I would think. Yeah.
As long as you're going fast enough, they are maneuverable, but you've got to be looking way ahead, especially on the Colorado, as you know.
Yeah, and you don't know what's coming up. That, Were the original drift boats and dories developed for fishing? Or, you know, are the ones we're talking about primarily developed for fishing, or did they have other purposes in the beginning on the Rogue and the Mackenzie?
The Mackenzie River drift boats specifically were developed for fly fishing.
Okay.
The Mackenzie, I don't know if any of the listeners have been on Mackenzie, but if you can imagine encountering that pristine river 125, 130, 40 years ago, and the river being alive with fish and working to fish that, it runs clear, it runs fast, and there are these sections of the river where you can step off rock and you think you're going into 2 or 3 feet of water and it's 8 or 10 feet deep. And it was something of a treacherous river to fish if you were really serious about fishing. And so beginning about 1910, some locals down there decided to try to use boats to get out and access those places where these rainbow could be more easily caught. And so the Mackenzie River drift boats were specifically employed, and as they evolved over time to improve their efficiencies in accessing the fishery. Now on the Rogue River, they too were originally designed for fishing, but it was commercial fishing. Down there, the early boats were river drivers, not unlike those that existed in the Northeast back during the Revolutionary period. And commercial fishing was a strong part of the economy. And then when gold was discovered around 1850 on the Rogue, boats came beasts of burden because the country there is so difficult to negotiate afoot or with mules. They found that carrying the equipment downriver in boats was just a lot more efficient. And that's what gave rise to the longer design of those boats and the ability to move them both directions on the river. And then in later years, in the 1920s, the boats began to evolve for more effective sports fishing under the tutelage of people like Glenn Wooldridge, who really popularized and made the Rogue famous as a sports fishery.
I know there were some interesting characters back in those early days and when these boats were developed. Are there any that you'd like to highlight for us tonight that you found interesting when you were writing?
I mentioned Marsh Underwood. This was before drift boat and the Rogue River dories. He obviously was very much a character, and I stumbled onto his diaries in the library archive, and it was really quite a find. Woody Hindman, it's spelled H-I-N-D-M-A-N, and most people pronounce it Hindman, the family pronounces it Hindman, moved to the Mackenzie River country in 1934 from McLean, Texas, fell in love with the river, and it wasn't long before he was fishing and guiding, and had a real knack for understanding boat form and function, and soon became a builder also. In 1939, he and his wife, Ruthie, well, actually, in June of 1939, Woody accompanied a couple of Mackenzie guides to run the Salmon River from Salmon City to Riggins. And on that trip, Woody floated past the mouth of the Middle Fork of the Salmon, and he thought to himself, gosh, that sure looks like a real fine fishing stream. So he made some inquiries about it and decided that he'd really like to run that. But he had one person he had to convince, and that was his wife, Ruthie. And when he returned from that trip in late June of 39, he writes in his diary, I'm just going to quote you here. He said, on arriving back to Eugene, Oregon, my home, the more I thought about the trip down the fork, the more I wanted to go. So I broke the news to Ruth, my wife, about this trip and asked her if she didn't think that would be a swell trip. Her answer was, well, of all dumb ideas of a good time, when do we start? And I thought on that time and place, that was quite a woman and quite a person for Woody to partner up with. In fact, on that first trip that they made, which they made in August of 39, Woody got sick and she ended up rowing most of that trip. And theirs was the first solo trip down the Middle Fork. And I think she was the first person of her gender to make that trip. There are tons of stories, guides on the Colorado. There's a fellow guiding some folks who was being directed by one of the, they call them dudes, one of the guests. There's a rock there, you know, giving them directions, don't hit that rock. He finally erupted. He said, look, damn it, I'm trying to hit every rock I possibly can. Don't disturb me anymore. So, yeah, there are a number of stories, and it's kind of hard to pick one out.
Sure.
If there's time before the end of the show, Roger, I'll tell one of about 3 weeks ago.
Maybe we'll save that for the end.
Sure now. Yeah, whatever.
Okay. Well, we need to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about the different kinds of boats and then how you got started and you know, getting into boat building and so forth. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. Housatonic Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services that they offer in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking to Roger Fletcher about drift boats and river dories. If you'd like to ask Roger a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of those questions on our show tonight. Roger, I always ask my guests this part of the show what's going on in their fly fishing world, so tell us about your projects and tell us about your website and what you offer folks there, too, boat building. So.
Okay. Well, the website is intended as much to be educational as anything else. There's a lot of information about the history of the boat. And I do make available to people who are interested plans, which include the lines and the construction detail and instructions for the boats that I have recovered. They're historic boats. And what I've tried to do, and I think have done fairly successfully, is to find key points in the revolution where there were significant enough changes in the design to take a snapshot of that. And so the boats represent those snapshots in time, all of which are highly functional boats. And so there are a number of people that come to me for plans, and the book itself actually contains 10 of the 13 boats that I have recovered, and people are building boats from the book. And consequently, I get a number of calls every week from folks asking about this or that, and I welcome those calls because if someone's going to take a boat building project, I want them to be successful, and I'm here to help as best I can. So I spend some time on the phone. My real interest is in my shop. I am not building boats full size, but today build models and work on limited editions primarily. These are boats that are scaled models of each of the boats as they evolved over time. And to the extent possible, I use the same material that went into the original boats. And it's a very time-consuming project, but it's something I thoroughly enjoy doing. And there are a number of these models now that adorn the man caves and the woman caves across the country and other parts of the world. In fact, I just finished up two river dories. One is going to replace one that left my collection. Someone wanted it so bad they were willing to pay me for it, and so it's replacing that boat. And another one I'm shipping off to an outfitter in Australia. So modeling, I'm doing that. Also, the way I got started into my research originally was to craft my passion, drift boats, as fine furniture. But because of the research in the last, actually 15 years now that I've been working on this, it's only recently that I got into recreating these boats as pieces of furniture. And the piece of furniture that I've been working on recently is an end table or a coffee table or a display table of the McKinsey River drift boat, the double ender with a transom. And they're really lovely pieces. They're inset with smoked glass. They sit on a stand. And everything is to scale, and the oars are displayed. And so people that are interested in these buy them as display items or as coffee tables or whatever. So I've got a number of things that keep me busy, and my wife really enjoys that. Yeah.
What's your website address so people can see what you're doing?
Oh, yeah. It's www.riverstouch, RIVERSTOUTH.com.
Okay.
And people that visit the website, I encourage them to migrate around and take a look at what's there. And if there are people interested in connecting with others who share their interest, there are a couple of excellent drift boat forums. that they can access through my link. They go to, on my homepage, there's a link called Friends. And if you click on that, it takes you to a list of drift boat aficionados and professional drift boat builders. And it's a great resource for someone that's looking to buy a drift boat or having one made for them or simply looking to connect with the drift boating world.
That's great. That's great. Well, thanks for sharing that. Well, terrific. You sound like a very busy individual.
Like we talked about earlier,
you don't use it, you lose it, right? So you might
that's
as well
right.
do it.
the other thing. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the other thing that I'm involved in, the McKenzie River Guides Association and Friends of the Old Leeburg Fish Hatchery are looking to develop a McKenzie River Interpretive Center. And because of the research I've done, I've been drawn into that, and that's going to take a considerable amount of time, but I think that's going to be a really piece of resident history down there once it comes to fruition.
That's nice. That's nice. Well, let's talk now. You did, in the past few minutes, mentioned how many boats, 16 or 18, that you've got, that you've recovered, is the word you used?
13. 13.
13?
Yeah.
13?
13.
And what do you mean by recovered?
Well, looking at the history of the boats, on the McKenzie, beginning about 1910, the first person to run a person down the river for pay, for fishing purposes, was a fellow by the name of Kerry Thompson. For a time, I thought it was Milo Thompson, but anyway, one of the Thompsons. And they used a heavily timbered, it was called Knoll's Scow. And it wasn't too long before the guiding business began to flourish, and they realized they needed a boat that was more efficient, more maneuverable, that met their needs. And so there began an evolution of the boats to what we have today, known as McKenzie River drift boats. And there are points in their evolution where significant enough change occurred that I wanted to recapture that point and reconstruct the boat, recover the lines and the construction details of that boat. Some I was able to do by finding old boats and taking the lines off the boats. Some I had to actually work with the families and those that remembered the boats to reconstruct the boat based on photographs and other pieces of information, parts of boats and so on. Each one of those boats, on average, took me about 300 hours of work to recover, and that meant establishing the lines of the boats. That meant crafting a plug, a scale plug or half model of the boat to scale, and then developing the plans, then modeling the boat, and then one way or the other building the boat full size to test the efficacy of hands. So each of the boats, when I say recovered, these are boats that have or are awfully close to being lost to time. And the most recent boat that I've recovered, I suppose I ought to come up with a better term than that, but in a sense really have repopularized, is the McKenzie River double ender with a transom, both a fellow by the name of Woody Heinemann built in 1948 at the request of another guide, Everett Spalding, and that boat was built in 1948. So the McKenzies and the Rogue River Dories, I look to identify those key points in time where significant changes took place and then recover that boat and represent its lines and its construction details so that it'd be my initial interest and primary interest was for posterity. There literally has been no record of these boats other than a shingle hanging in a shop here or there with some basic measurements, but from those measurements and angles, you could not build the boat that information was needed to build. So.
Great,
that's
great. Well, what do you think of today, where it's the designs have gone today to fiberglass and other materials? Do you consider that advancement or regression?
Well, I simply say the evolution continues.
Yeah.
Of course, with wood, which is, I'm sure there are some fly fishers out there that will say, I'll never fish any other way than with a fly rod, and I prefer a bamboo fly rod. And I'm something of a wood boat snob. There's something about the warmth and the quiet and the responsiveness and the character of wood that is unmatched by any other material. The problem with wood is that it, if left exposed to the weather, is going to deteriorate. Hence, when aluminum boats began to arrive on the scene back in the late 1970s, Williamsworth was one of the first out of Medford. The beauty of aluminum is that you can come home from a fishing trip and leave that thing outside, maybe hose it out, but just leave it and it's going to be fine. So too with fiberglass, just not going to decay on you. So the materials that have become popular, you don't see a whole lot of wood boats anymore, although I will say that they are resurging in popularity, and I like to think it's in part because of my book. But aluminum and fiberglass really have become the boats of choice, and particularly among the guiding community.
Yeah.
And I understand that, and I appreciate that. And I am not so snobbish that I would not set foot inside an aluminum or a fiberglass drift boat, especially if there's a river to run.
Yeah, and you kind of hit the point for guides, you know, when they've got people in and out of those boats every day, you know, 8 hours a day. That's a lot of wear and tear on a boat, so... And your guests may not be as appreciative of the wood as you are either.
So, well, one of the interesting things that I see happening, and it's on the McKinsey and to a little lesser extent on the Rogue River, guides are going back to wood. And I think in part it's a deepening appreciation of the history of the boats and the heritage that these boats carry. And the cultural value that they see in those. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the name Helfrich, but Prince Helfrich was a good friend of Woody Hindman, and Prince became a guiding legend in Oregon and the Northwest. Three of his sons and now grandchildren are still guiding, and they became very enamored with the Middle Fork of the Salmon River and have been guiding on the Middle Fork in addition to the McKinsey and the Rogue for years. And the time was that they would either raft or use aluminum boats, but they're gravitating back to wood. And I think that in part is both an appreciation of their heritage and also to reconnect with the time past and give their clients an experience that they think fits their heritage.
When did you first get interested in drift boats and river dories? How did this whole thing start for you?
1967. I have a good friend who had a drift boat. Both he and his wife enjoyed it, and they invited my wife and I and our kids to have a drift boating experience, which we took advantage of, and we ran a river called the Sandy Am, Willamette Valley River, from a ways up to the confluence of the Sandy Am and the Willamette, and I just fell in love with the boat and what it does. It just a few minutes, you're away from things, and it's quiet, and the riffles, and there weren't any really heavy rapids on that stretch, but the thing I remember thinking, wow, this is kind of like running life, for goodness sakes. You know, you got to chart your course, you've got to anticipate, you've got to look ahead, you've got to plan a little bit, and then you've got to position the boat to navigate that particular piece of water. So within a year, I had my own drift boat. And it was a boat built, actually called a Rob built boat by the name of John Ostrom, who is well known in among boat building circles of 40 years ago. And I took the boat and finished it and built the thwarts and the floorboards and whatnot. And so that's where it started. And I have two girls and a family dog at that time, and we would take our vacations in that drift boat. We would run the Rogue and run the Deschutes River and sometimes the John Day and sometimes the Sandy Am and sometimes the coastal streams. And so that's when I got started and they got started. And I've been forever indebted to my friend.
Yeah. Now, so that was, you kind of, sounds like you finished a boat that was already built there. When did you first build your first boat?
It was a lot later in life. Yeah, it was a lot later in life. It wasn't until I really got into my research, which began in about 1995, 94. And there is a fellow who passed away 2 years ago. His name is Harold Dynamite Payson. And anyone familiar with boats in the boating world would recognize that name right away. Lived in Maine, was a lobsterman for a number of years, built dories, got interested in modeling boats, and never completed high school, and yet over the course of his life he wrote 12 books. And when I started my research, he was the person that I wanted to meet, because he had been doing for a number of years what I thought needed to be done here in the Northwest to recover and record the stories and the lines and construction detail of these boats. And so I made it a point to hook up with him, and we hit it off. And my wife's family is from Connecticut, and they have property in Maine. And so it was fortuitous in that we try to go back there every year, and it was therefore easy for me to connect with him. So in terms of developing the expertise needed to recover boats, establish the lines, craft the models, and then build the boats full size, he's my teacher. He's my mentor. And we have maintained a very close working relationship over those years. And as I was working on the book itself, it was a 3,000-mile transcontinental connection. Spent a lot of time on the phone. And then another person that was extraordinarily helpful, Sam Manning. Sam is an artist and a boat builder and understands the in and outs of boats and has done a lot of illustrating for magazines, especially Wooden Boat Magazine, and he illustrated John Gardner's The Dory Book. I met him, and 1 year I asked him if there would be any chance he'd be willing to take a look at drift boats and help me illustrate my own book if I decided to write it. Well, the short story is that he actually illustrated Chapter 11, which details the construction of the boats from beginning to end. So it was that connection with Dynamite, and then again a little later with Sam, that I really worked to forge my ability relative to both modeling and building boats. I have 5 grandchildren, and 2 of them, I've helped them design and build their own boat. One was a drift boat, another was a canoe, and another one wanted to build a bamboo bike. A bike out of wood, and so
I've seen those. Counsel
there. So I'm a fairly late comer.
Were you an experienced woodworker before you built your first boat, or was this new to you?
No.
You weren't. Okay. So in your mind, somebody with little or no experience in woodworking can build a boat, right?
If a person can draw a straight line, if they can understand angles, a few of which are compound, but be able to visualize them in their head, if they can operate a skill saw or a table saw, a draw knife or a hand plane, and can do that and basically know how to read and understand the set of lines, they can build a boat. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of people that have successfully done that. And and my story to people is, look, if I can do it, you can do it.
Right.
In terms of building.
Tim Baer in Eureka, Illinois wrote in, and he says, I've always thought it would be really cool to build my own wooden drift boat. I have a few wood strip canoes, and I have over 25 years in fine woodworking. Is there a small drift boat plan out there? I'm thinking about a 10 to 12 foot size. What are your thoughts? So I'm sure you got the plan for them, right?
Well, there are a couple sets of plans on my website that you might want to take a look at. There's a fellow back in Pennsylvania by the name of Dave Zielinski that has designed. I helped him with the design part of it and the plans, and he sells his plans through my site. Also, again, if they go to my friends link on my homepage, they'll also be able to hook up with some boat builders that sell boats of this size. I always caution people when they start thinking about a boat to build. The caution is, what do you want to do with it? One of the greatest lesson I've learned is that form follows function. And so much depends on what your intent is and how you intend to use the boat. That will say a lot about how, what kind of a river boat you would like to try to build.
Okay, good. Need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk more about building boats and putting them on the rivers. So stick with us, folks. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 907-274-713. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking to Roger Fletcher about drift boats and river dories. If you'd like to ask Roger a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. We do have a couple questions come in here on the Internet, Roger. One from Phil Cox in Murray. He says, what's your favorite river to float, since you've floated all the ones in Oregon?
My favorite is the Rogue River.
Rogue, okay.
Yep.
And he also asked, what kind of oars do you like best, composite or wood?
I'm partial to wood. Composite is good. I think they tend to be a little heavier. At my age, I've gotten a little long in the tooth. It used to be that I used ash oars. I have gravitated to spruce. The strength to weight ratio is excellent, which means they're reliable and they're a lot lighter for handling. But you're not going to go wrong either way. If you go with wood, I would think ash. I would also think spruce, depending on your river conditions and how much work you want to do on the oars.
Okay. Now, you don't make your own oars, I take it. You have those built-in.
I do, but I don't market them, no. A lot of people prefer to make their own oars, and they're really fairly, they're uncomplicated at all.
Oh, really?
Dynamite. Okay. Yeah. Dynamite Payson has a description of how to do it on his website, even though he's passed away. His site is still active, and his plans are still available, and he can again be found through my friend's link on my website. But, yeah, they're also purchasable. There are some very fine manufactured oars that people can acquire.
There's a Bob Berta in Brush Prairie, Washington, wrote in, and he said, this is from the Internet as well, I own a 1993 Rays River Dory Rapid Robert. Any comments you might have would be welcome pertaining to the design and builder for quality and performance. So he just wants to know what you think of that particular boat.
Are you aware of it? Oh, yes. And if he has a Ray's built Rapid Robert, he has the creme de la creme. Ray is an artist with wood and is an exquisite boat builder. And the Rapid Robert is one of Ray's favorite boats and one of mine also, because it has dual purpose capability. It can run fairly comfortably class 3 water with a 9.9 horse motor on it. You can run yourself back up a lot of streams, and that boat will actually get up and playing. Now, if he's got a Ray-built Rapid Robert, he has a real treasure.
Good. There you go, Bob. So, let's see here. Okay, let's dig back in here, talk more about boat building and so forth. You had mentioned, well, first of all, Tim Knight wrote in, and he said from Grand Haven, Michigan, he said, what type of wood is the best to build a boat with? So you want to talk about wood for a few minutes?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Traditionally, these boats have been built, the early boats, of course, were plank and board and batten boats, but the more contemporary, built out of plywood. We're talking wood boats. And in this part of the country, most boats are constructed. They're also built what I call free-form constructed. They're built without a form or a strong back. which makes them pretty darn efficient and considerably less expensive to build. Doug fir has been the wood of choice for panels, marine-grade panels. These boats don't require thick skin. The side panels are typically quarter-inch marine-grade fir. The bottom panel can, depending on the size of the boat, can be anything from 3/8 inch to 1/2 inch. Some like to go a little heavier, but the problem is if you go heavier because of the rocker, it's a little more difficult to get that bottom panel down onto the hull of the boat. For framing, originally the most popular wood was Port Orford cedar, a very light, strong wood for the boats a little bit lighter. Today, you're looking at probably spruce, Doug fir. The problem that has come about because of the loss of our old growth forests, high quality Doug fir panels are increasingly rare. Consequently, boat builders have gone to alternate material. And these are tropical hardwood panels, akumi, which comes out of West Africa, sapele, out of West Africa, are woods that are fairly commonly used now. Probably the most common is a Philippine mahogany. Isn't really a true mahogany, but it's the trade name is Miranti, M-I-R-A-N-T-I. And the best Miranti for that is what's called a red Miranti. That is fairly accessible, and there's I won't mention the brand name, but there are products available that people can acquire. The unfortunate thing is that the loss of Doug fir as the material of choice has been a real loss, and while you can still get some, it's quite difficult, and you're going to spend a lot more money for it.
Now, are these wood that people can get locally in their communities, or are they going to have to special order some of this?
It depends on where they are. Back over time, boats really kind of took on, the shapes that they took on because they were built from indigenous material, and that material really helped define the boat. If you're in the Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, you should be able to find sources for any one of these materials. Sometimes it's a bit difficult to do that, but one of the helps that might be, if I could mention another website, Glenn L, Glenn-L, Boat Designs. They have, for a number of years, listed sources for boat building material in each of the states. And my suggestion is for someone interested in trying to see if there is material available locally to go to that website and look for their source material. They've got a web page where they list all the vendors for lumber and plywood that, to their knowledge, sells boat quality material, and check those sources out.
Okay. Earlier, you ran down kind of a laundry list of equipment tools that one would need, and I think you pretty much covered the major tools and smaller ones. Are there anything really specialized that one would need to have, or did you pretty much cover it all back then?
I think that pretty much covered it. If you have a saw, you're better off than if you're using a skill saw.
Yeah.
If you have a planer or a joiner, that could make your life a little bit easier. But bottom line, if all you have is a skill saw and a hand plane, I'm trying to think, you should be able to, and a hand drill, either power or a manual drill. One of the beauties of these dories is the lines are basically straight. There are some angles to them, and so there isn't a lot of wowie, as I call it, wowie cutting that's required.
Yeah. Now, we did get a question from Phil Cox again on the Internet. He says, I guess he's run a lot of rivers in Utah and the Green River and so forth. There's a lot of rocks. Do you use any special kind of coating on the bottom for protection of the wood?
Yeah. Two ways I like to do it. I'd like to have at least a 1/2 inch of bottom on my boat, and then cover that with at least 20, preferably 24 ounces of triaxial fiberglass cloth, and then wet it in with epoxy resin and give it a number of coats. And then the last several coats, mix in some graphite, black graphite, and move the bottom up. It's very easy to repair. The bottom is just as slick as you can possibly think, and it takes a lot of abuse. My favorite, however, is to overlay the bottom with quarter-inch shot plywood. The last piece, once the bottom's done, that goes on the boat is called the outside chine cap. It's the piece that takes all the abuse. But before I apply that last piece, I will lay down a quarter-inch piece of shot plywood to cover the bottom. And I'll probably oil it. I'll oil the bottom of the boat, oil the plywood, lay it down, mark it, cut it to fit. And then I'll use the silicon bronze screws to screw it down. I won't glue it down. I'll screw it down, and that bottom is going to be about as bulletproof as you can possibly imagine. One of the problems that boaters will run into hitting rocks is they won't notice a fracture on the underside of the bottom panel, but if they look carefully, they'll begin to see fractures on the inside of the bottom panel. You won't see that usually if you use quarter-inch plywood as protection. You will if you use fiberglass and some other material.
Okay, very interesting. Now, do you recommend building a model first to understand the boat better before you're building a full-size boat?
If someone has not built the boat before, your boat, and are interested in learning how the boats hang together, I would definitely recommend that. I do market a couple of modeling kits, and the reason I developed the kits and the instructions that go along with the modeling kits, the material that goes with the kits, is everything is to scale, but basically they've got to, the modeler has got to go through the same protocol as they would for building the full-size boat. That's a great confidence builder. And so, yes, I would. In fact, Columbia River Maritime Museum has invited me up to teach a drift boat building class. And what we have decided to do is, rather than get into the business of building a boat full size, engage everyone in modeling their own drift boat and taking them through the protocol for modeling that parallels building the boat full size. And my experience has been people that have done that enter the boat building phase with just a lot more confidence.
Yeah,
they'll make a mistake
like
here
it.
Or there. But yeah.
What are, and we're sort of running out of time, and I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking about boat handling, but can you just kind of run us through, you know, in briefly, what the major steps are to building a boat, if you can break that down?
Okay. Yeah, I think I can. And I'm going to talk frame construction and a technique I call freeform construction, which would be true for any set of plans in the book. Or what you do is you get your quarter-inch marine-grade panel and you mark them out. You establish the bow, the transom lines. Then you establish station lines. That's where each frame will be placed. And you cut that panel out. And one of the nice things about most of the McKinseys is that you can get two side panels out of one 4x16-foot sheet of quarter-inch marine-grade plywood. And so you cut the panels out, and then you go about the task of defining the stem dimensions, and you cut your stem, then form the transom, and then form at least two, maybe sometimes three, of the centermost frames for the boat. And the first step you do is you attach the side panels to the stem. There are some steps that you need to go through in terms of sealers and stuff that will prevent leakage and weeping. But just in terms of hanging the boat together, attach side panels to the stem, and then one side of the transom to the stern end of the boat, and then the other side to the other side of the transom, using one of the frames as a spreader. Once you have the side panels attached, the stem and the transom, you basically have your hull. And what you do next then is to form each of the frames and install from the centermost frame, fore and aft, alternating until all frames are installed. Then once they're installed, the boat's going to be awfully limber and will rack if you're not carefully. That'll twist. And so you need to figure out a way to square the boat up, lay the bottom panel on, and mark it, cut it, and affix the bottom panel to the hull, and voila, you have your hull. Now, I've left one step out, and that's the inside chine log, which has got to go in before the bottom panel is on. Then it's a matter of flipping the boat, and you're looking at basic carpentry work from then on in terms of constructing your thwarts, your fly line deck, your knee locks for the fly fisher, or on the Colorado and the River Dory, you know, you don't, typically they don't put a fly line deck in on the traditional boat. And that's basically it. You know, you're looking at, you're looking at 60 to 65 hours to form the hull for a beginner, I think.
Okay, and you could do this all in your garage, basically, it sounds like.
You could. You could.
Yep.
The biggest
yep.
problem is when you attach the side panels to the stem post, those side panels are flared out quite a way, so that you need space to do that, but you can move the boat outside temporarily to do that.
Yeah. Sounds like you could use a couple extra hands at certain times during the procedure.
Oh, yeah.
Too, huh? Yeah.
And a beer or two.
And a beer or two. Okay. Yeah, never hurt. Well, let's talk. I think at that point, at this point, people just need to, you know, get your book, get some plans, build a model, you know, and dive in. Sounds like that's where we're at. There's just too much involved to get into the details of it. We'll be here for...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Roger, if I might, anyone, I am very accessible. I do my phone number on my website and my email address. Email is probably the easiest way to get hold of me for inquiries. But if someone is building a boat and they need some counsel, oh gosh, call me. I get those inquiries regularly, and I really appreciate them because things are happening because of the work I've been doing, and I want to support that.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about drift boat handling for a few minutes. We're going to talk about some basics here. I've got some basic questions. I think this is all important because, geez, you know, if you build a beautiful boat like this, you want to be able to handle it properly.
Right.
I, as you have rowed a lot of rivers and know the dangers involved, and especially when you're in your own, those rocks are not kind by any means. So.
Right.
So, Kyle in Anchorage, Alaska, actually wrote, and he says, for those of us accustomed to rowing rafts, what are the advantages of drift boats over fly fishing? I thought, well, maybe that's a good place to start. And, you know, advantages and disadvantages both.
You know, I've never fished from a raft, so I'm a poor one. I'm a poor one to make that comparison. But I have rowed rafts, but I've never fished from. But I would, based on my limited experience with rafts, I would think one advantage would be the flexibility for the fisher to stand up, lock their knees in a knee lock, and be able to control their line pretty darn effectively. That fly line deck in the front has a purpose, and that's to catch your excess line. And also the maneuverability. I appreciate rafts, but I have a friend that refers to them as ungainly bags of gas. And as such, one would assume that maneuverability can be an issue.
Right, right.
And so...
I've rowed both, and I would agree. You know, the rafts tend to be more sluggish in the water. You can't move them as quickly. You know, the drift boats are much more agile. But the other side of it is there's some rivers here in Colorado I won't take my drift boat down because... you are going to hit rocks. It doesn't matter how good you are. It's just they are rocky rivers, and you're going to hit them, and I just don't want to take my boat down, but I'll take a raft down. So that's
You bet.
The kind of water you're running.
They're considerably more forgiving.
Yeah, yeah. So they bounce a lot nicer. Lawrence in Arkansas wrote in, and he says, how does a novice learn how to use a drift boat and fast-moving water, rivers. What would your suggestion to a newbie be to learn?
Well,
about
that's a question I get quite a bit, and it's something I really am concerned about, because as people build these things, the first thing they're going to do is launch them and get out on the river. And there are considerations and care that needs to be exercised. I think one of the first things I would do would be to make sure I've got someone, knows someone, or has a friend who has experience on the river, and engage that person and talk them into helping you your first two or three excursions out on the river. There's a book called Drift Boats, A Complete Guide, that was written by an Oregonian. His name is Dan Alsup, A-L-S-U-P. I think it's published by Frank D'Amato Publications in Portland. He's done a pretty darn good job of describing river currents and how you anticipate and how you maneuver the boat in order to avoid obstacles. But at some point, you've got to grab the bull by the horns and get on the oars and solo. But I would not do that until I have enough confidence that would be brought about by some experienced person having mm-hmm. given me some right. pointers and been with me in the boat. Here in Oregon, there are a couple of guys. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you encourage new rowers to learn how to read the water before taking the oars in hand?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, very definitely. It's once you get a little experience under your belt, it's pretty easy to become a little more confident than your experience sometimes would allow. And so anytime there's a stretch of water that looks like it might present a challenge, you want to stop above, scout it out, establish your line, and then run it, but not run it blind.
Yeah, I know. One thing I've noticed in teaching friends of mine to row rafts or drift boat is always learning to read the water first and learning the power of the water and mm-hmm. understanding that before they take the oars. And I had experience last year. I took my girlfriend out in the drift boat. We did a couple-day float, and she wasn't too interested in fishing, but she really loved rowing the boat. So,
right.
But the first few hours, I just had her, you know, sit in the front of the boat and describe what she was seeing to me, you know, and
mm-hmm.
what,
mm-hmm.
what's the water doing? Where's it going? And then mm-hmm. then I started telling her, now, if you were going to do this, what would you do next? And so I had to run it through her mind and everything, and then by the time I gave her the oar, she did darn good. By the end of the day, I was fishing from the boat, and she was ringing, and we were both happy. So, but a lot of it was learning that water, because people get underestimated, I've always found.
Yep.
You know, they're always pulling too late, way too long, and then they're in trouble.
Yep.
There's
an old river saying, go with the flow, but manage your direction. There was a guide, a fellow by the name of Leroy Pruitt, that taught newbies for a number of years. And he had actually got them out into a creek. And he would help them understand the hydraulics and how obstructions will cause the water to react in certain ways. Sometimes you'll be going down and you see this little pillow out in front of you, and you don't think anything of it. Well, the reason that pillow's there is because there's something underneath, and you don't know how deep it is if you're on water that you haven't run before. It needs to be taken very seriously, and it's good advice to get some help in terms of reading the water. Yeah.
Do you prefer to have your, and this is kind of the taste rower I found, but do you prefer to have your oars free moving in the locks or locked in? And maybe you have some ideas on advantages and disadvantages of both.
Well, I do. I carry some biases on that one. I like open horn locks. And there are a couple different kinds that are out there on the market. But the open horn, if they're bronze locks, they have some stability to them. And so what I do, once I've wrapped the oar, I always wrap my oars, once the oar is wrapped, I will tamp the horn of the oar lock down so that that oar is going to stay in lock. And to insert it, then you've got to go up to the blade and then slip it through the loom. And the reason I don't like circular or closed door lock is that if you get into trouble, let's say you get the blade of the oar caught between a couple of rocks, in an instant, if that oar doesn't have some give to it, the lock doesn't have some give, you could tear the side panel off that boat or tear the gunwale off. On the other hand, if you have open oar locks, even though you have tamped those things down, that oar lock is going to spring, and that oar is going to pop out, which leads to the other suggestion, never, ever run a drift boat without a spare oar that you can get to very quickly, because you can lose an oar fairly easily. And you
or bust one. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. I had the unfortunate experience once of a friend of mine riding in that. This was a raft, but he was riding on the back, on the huge bundle back there. And we went down a chute and into a hole, and it basically folded the raft in half. And right. He came forward behind me and hit his head in the back of my head. Just about knocked me, and I was dizzy, and I was just trying to, find my oars, much less maneuver the boat.
Right.
But I didn't expect it to get knocked out from behind. But that forced me within seconds into a wall, and there went an oar. Snap. It was it doesn't take much, and that oar was gone. So I've been there, done that kind of thing.
I have a friend that was on the Rogue River not too long ago, and there's a rapid just below Blossom Bar called Sturgis, and there's a big eddy on the far right. If you get too far right, you're going to go into that eddy, and it'll hold you there. And as he was going into it, he popped the oar to fend the boat off the rock wall, and the pressure, of course, drove that oar right through the side panel below the water line on the other side of the boat. Caution and care, and thinking things through ahead of time. Safety has got to be of paramount importance. Anytime.
Expect the unexpected, right?
Exactly.
Can you just kind of give us some principles about, basic principles about rowing and positioning a boat on the water that is different if a person is, rowed a rowboat or something?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about using the water as your propulsion. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Maybe you can throw in fairing, about that.
In a drift boat, you're basically doing, compared to a rowboat, every backwards. You're rowing against the current. The idea is to slow your descent. There is rafters and drift boaters describe a technique called ferrying, and that's the way moving the boat laterally across the current in order to govern your direction. You stay with the flow and to avoid obstacles. So the key really is being able to understand left from right. You pivot the boat, and if you're coming upon an obstacle, you want to point the bow of the boat or the prow of the boat toward that and pull against it, but at an angle so that you're actually cutting across the current to slip past. That requires some looking far enough downriver. Some drift boaters have the tendency to look directly over the bow and scan the river maybe 50 feet to 30 yards downstream. You really have got to be looking at the full scope of things. So being able to manage the boat, maneuver the boat across the current either direction, and to think a little slower than the current than faster than the current. Unless you're in really huge water, like on the Colorado, where you've got to bust through some of those big waves. But there you're not looking as much at maneuverability as you are stability.
And survival.
And survival, that's right. and survival.
Yeah, I had the experience on the Colorado in an 18-foot raft with, you know, a couple thousand pounds of gear in it, and have go into a hole and have the wave totally engulf the whole raft, go the whole thing, so you're all underwater. And I was just, whoa. That's what I mean, five.
It's pretty impressive.
But you're not doing that when you're fishing, hopefully.
No.
That's a little bit different. What other common mistakes do you see beginner rowers making out there when they're trying to move their boat around?
I think waiting too long. The rule of thumb that really good oarsmen state is that if you're using your oars a lot, you're not using the river as you should. You're not anticipating, and you're not letting the river do your work for you. There was a guide by the name of his goal was to use his oars as little as possible, in part because he said, I'm lazy, but also because he knew how to read the water, where to position the boat, and slip by obstacles. But I would say, don't lose your anticipatory skills and abilities. There are basically two kinds of boaters, those that have erred and those that are gonna. And the idea is to keep those errors to a minimum for the safety of yourself and the safety of your occupants.
And I think using the oars to a minimum definitely pays if you're doing long trips too, you know?
Because it will
wear on you lifting those oars to, you know. And that's always my goal too, is to use those as least as possible because it's a workout. You know, it's a workout. Well, you said there was a we're out of time here, but you said there was a short story you wanted to tell us about.
One of the things I think about what's one of my most memorable trips? It was about three weeks ago, actually. And I'll try. I will be brief. But my boating partner of almost 50 years, he turned 80 last spring. Last fall, we decided we were going to go steelhead fishing over on the Nastucca. And being a little bit longer in the tooth these years, we decided to wait until mid-morning to leave, which we did. And we got over there, and it was raining a little bit. He looked at me, and he said, you know, maybe we ought to have an early lunch. So we went over at the Pelican Pub and had lunch. And about 12:30, we started back, and he had seen a program that featured Terry Learned, a Pacific Cape dory builder, whom I knew. And I said, well, stop by and see if he's in the shop. He was. So we killed another hour there. By 2 o'clock, I said to Ken, I said, you know, the bite's on, so let's get going. So we head up, and we had a boat, but I was hauling it with my vehicle, and we backed down to the put-in. And I said, Ken, where's your lead rope? And, oh, gosh, he says, I forgot it. And so he said, no problem. And so he grabbed the anchor rope at the back end of the boat. And when he puts his ropes together, you can take either end and pull, and it'll come just straight as an arrow. So he pulled that through the eye hook on the bow. I shoved the boat off. He's pulling on the rope. And all of a sudden, he's got the end of that anchor rope in his hand, and that boat 40 feet out in the river. And the short story is that we were able to retrieve the boat with some difficulty, but several days later I asked Ken, I said, Ken, what was the first thought that went through your mind when you saw the boat out there? And he said, you know, Roger, I looked at that boat, and I thought, that's a beautiful boat. That's a beautiful looking boat. The short story is we never got on the river that day. but that's one of my most memorable trips. Oh, man. There's a book
there
in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, good. That's a good note to,
Well, the lesson, Roger, is, to say a little bit differently, there are those drift boaters that have done some really dumb things, and there are drift boaters that are going to do some really dumb things. Those are the two.
Yeah, it's like when we were on the Colorado River, my brother-in-law was in the back of the boat, and I said, can you give me a beer? You know, we had the beer and the dragnet in the back and drag it to the river. And he says, sure. So he pulls up the bag of beer and he gets me a beer and he ties up the bag, but he didn't tie the rope on the end of the bag. He threw the bag over the back end with no rope, and a case of beer went to the bottom of the Colorado River. I still haven't forgiven him for that. Because on a 21-day trip, you know, you don't go to the nearest store to get beer.
No.
So that was a funny story I had, too. Yeah. Well, listen, we got to wrap things up here, and we got some prizes to give away. So stick with us, and Roger, you stick with me, too, here, so we can give away your book and so forth. And we'll be right back giving away that one-year membership Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription, the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and, of course, Roger's book, Drift Boats and River Dories, and two sets of plans that we're going to give away. So stick with us, folks, and see if you'll win. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature support network, and which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. It's reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please let us know how we did on the show tonight. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register yet, it's a little late now, but make sure to do so for our next show and see if you can't win. So the first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And by the way, if you win one, we'll get in contact with you after the show to make sure you get your prize. So the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to know more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and learn about what their projects are and how they're helping out and how you can help out, too. It's a great organization and quite the learning experience as well. Well, our winner there is Jeff Stevens in California, so congratulations, Jeff Stevens, and I know you'll enjoy your membership there. Our second thing we're going to give away is a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of Amato Books. And you can learn more about the books and publications Amato has at amatobooks.com. Amatobooks.com. And our winner here is Bernie Robidart in Alabama. So, Bernie, I hope you enjoy your new subscription. And just jotting down your name there. Okay. And in Alabama. Terrific. Well, congrats, Bernie. Well, now our next thing we're going to do is give away a copy of Roger's book. Two sets of plans, one for the McKenzie River Drift Boat and one for the Rapid Robert. And the way we do this is I'm going to ask a question, and because we have three gifts tonight, we'll do a first, second, and third place prize here, which we don't normally do. So first person gets the book, the second person will get the McKenzie River Drift Boat plans, and the third winner will get the 14-foot Rapid Robert plans. So I'm going to make this real easy tonight because we're running out of time, and I want to make sure that we get these gifts out right away. So when we were talking at the beginning of the show, there were two rivers where these dories and drift boats were kind of born on. What are those two rivers, both those river names? And we'll see here. Now, Roger, I'm waiting for them to type it in and send it through our message box. And I know that's an easy question, but we want to get these prizes out to somebody. So let's see who we have here. And we're still checking. And, I'm checking the wrong place. How's that? Okay, first one, Up is the Rogue and the Mackenzie. He's got it, doesn't he, Roger?
Yes.
Okay, so that's our first winner. James, you just won Roger's book, Drift Boats and River Dories. And you're going to love this book, 8.5 by 11 book, lots of pictures, drawings, full-length motion picture movie in it, and a free drift boat. All comes in that one book. So, no, it's a great book. You're going to love it. And second one up, Rogue and Mackenzie. They got it. Okay, that'd be Eric in Cottage Grove, Oregon. You just got yourself plans for a Mackenzie River drift boat. So congrats on that. And then Phil Cox, you got yourself plans for a 14-foot Rapid Robert. So there we go. We got some winners tonight. And thanks for playing, guys. And I'm glad you all won something. And thank you, Roger, for being on the show tonight and taking your valuable time with us. And I tell you, I learned a lot about boats, and I have a lot more respect for them now than I ever did. So I appreciate that.
Pleasure to be with you, Roger.
Right.
As far as boats are concerned, I'm not at a loss of words.
Yeah, that's for sure, yeah. Oh, and by the way, James, Eric, and Phil, the winners tonight, you'll need to send me your mailing address. I have all your email addresses here and your names. Actually, Eric, I need a last name for you. But send me either in the same text box that you just sent your answer in, or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Send me your name, mailing address, so that we can get this stuff sent out to you. I appreciate it. Well, thanks, everybody, for being with us tonight. Our next broadcast is going to be on June 19th, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. In that show, we're going to interview John Harp, and our topic for the show will be the Canales River Magic. John has guided fly fishers for over 17 years on the Canales River in southern Colorado, and discover with us one of the last pristine, undeveloped river systems in the West, and learn about big wild brown and rainbow trout you can hook up into there. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Hoosac River Outfitters, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.